Good morning and welcome to Lake Country Unitarian Universalist Church. My name is Jim Hansen. I'll be your board rep today. It's a gorgeous day out there today, so hopefully we can get out and enjoy it this afternoon. We have a variety of announcements, as always, on church life and activities. Most of them are in your order of service, so we encourage you to take that order of service home with you and read it. And as always, there's a few extras. Today marks week 3 of our Time, Talent, and Treasure Silent Auction. So members and friends, donate the treasures you see out there. And rumor has it new items will be placed out there shortly. So we encourage you to make your bids. Next Sunday is the final day. And also, I'd like to remind you that the Suic Fruits and Nuts Sale is going on. That will be for another 2 weeks, and there's some order forms around. And talk to me or get me your checks made out to Suic with your order forms. And next week is the Halloween party. There will be a Bearded adults and children should wear costumes. There will be a trick-or-treat parade, if you will, for UNICEF after the service. So please bring some loose change and feel free to dress up. And Chris, did you have a question? Well, any Chris really would be appropriate at this point in time.
I'm visiting today, and how would I find out more about your church and Unitarian Universalism?
You should pick up one of these flyers.
What's that all about, Al?
At this time, I'd like to invite you to greet those sitting around you.
Good morning.
Good morning. Chris was a little slow on the pickup, but okay. If you are visiting with us today, we particularly welcome you and encourage you to sign the guest ledger on the visitors table in the foyer. There's a variety of information on the table about our church and Unitarian Universalism, so we encourage you to take anything that may interest you. I'll be in the social hall after the service if you have any questions. And if you are visiting with your children, it is our custom for the children to remain with us until after the story for all ages, at which time they go to their religious education classes. And your child is welcome to join in the classes or remain in the service. And if you need nursery care, it is just out the door across the hall. Classes end at 11:15, at which time you can pick up your kids. We always enjoy getting to know our guests. If any members have brought guests today, or any people are here on their own and would like to introduce themselves, now would be the time. Everyone is invited to gather in the social hall after the service for refreshments and conversation. Conversation Corner is a good place to continue discussions of the service, and we encourage you to put your cell phones on silence mode during the service. Hope you find this morning's service inspiring. And our speaker today is Nicholas Cable. He's a lifelong Unitarian Universalist, currently pursuing his Master of Divinity at Chicago Theological Seminary. He was raised in Milwaukee until he moved to Chicago in 2007 and attended DePaul University, where he graduated in 2011, summa cum laude, with degrees in religious studies, peace, justice, and conflict studies. His passion in academic and activist settings revolves around the methods and practices for sustainable interfaith engagement. He served as an interfaith fellow at DePaul and the Interfaith Youth Corps, and is currently a ministry fellow through the Fund for Theological Education. The sermon that will be shared today received the 2012 Central Midwest District's Sermon Award and has been shared with nearly a dozen congregations throughout the Midwest District. He's committed to cultivating a culture of competency for interfaith engagement in Unitarian Universalist congregations, and is thankful to be invited to continue that discussion with us here today. Thank you.
an old rabbi was out late one night walking with his students. He turned to them and asked, "Tell me how you can tell the day from the night." One student responded, "Is it when you can look at an animal way off in the distance and know whether it is a sheep or a goat?" "No," replied the rabbi. "Is it," asked another, "when you can see an apple or a tree off in the distance and know whether it is an apple tree or a fig tree?" "No," replied the rabbi again. "Well, then what is it?" demanded the students. "It is when you can look into the face of another and know that he or she is your kin. Because if you do not know that, it is still night." With our eyes open and our hearts ready to receive this day, come, let us worship together.
Please rise as you are willing and able to sing hymn number 347, "Gather the Spirit." Now's the time for our story for all ages. Well, I've got a deep voice on this. I invite the children or any of those, young and old, to come forward and help me with the story today. Pull up some carpet here. Well, not really, but seat yourself. Today's story is called "Old Joe and the Carpenter," and I'm going to tell you the story, but I'm going to need some help because I find it somewhat out of date with the kind of stories that I would relate to. So this is a story that starts out that there were once two friends. And where do you think they lived? I mean, where do you guys live?
Wisconsin.
Okay, what city? Milwaukee. Okay, so there's one of them. They lived in Milwaukee. These were two old friends that lived in Milwaukee, and they had farms in Milwaukee. They grew up there on their farms in Milwaukee, because this was, I mean, it's old Joe, so it's before Milwaukee was as big as it is now. And they lived there. They grew up together. They were best friends. They had a great time together. But it doesn't have to be Milwaukee. This could be, you know, you could imagine that this was your house and that this is, you know, it was two friends that had rooms next to each other, or brother and sister that had a room next to each other. Or you could imagine that this was some people who lived in Arizona, and one friend was on Arizona side and the other side was in the Mexico side. So there's lots of different ways to tell this story. But this was old Joe, and he and his friend grew up in Milwaukee on their farms together. And they had a great time with each other. They both learned to ride bicycles at the same time, to skateboard. They liked the same bands. They went to the same schools. They both majored in veterinary sciences because that was way cool then. And eventually, you know, they were there on their farms, and their wives had both passed away, and their kids had grown up and moved on to other things, to Boston and other large cities and so on. And so they pretty much just had each other there as their two best friends. And one day this stray calf came by, and it was wandering back and forth along their farms, and they both saw it and said, "Ooh, I could add this to my cow collection," because farms often have cow collections. And they both went out and they tried to claim the calf. And old Joe said, "You know, that's definitely my calf." And he was talking to his friend. His friend was named Walt, by the way. So Walt said, no, this is definitely my calf. I'm pretty sure this is one of old cow Bessie's calves." And they argued about it. They had a fight. They had a really big fight. They called each other names. They got really mean. They called each other body part names, like elbow, your stupid elbow. You're an ankle. You're nothing but an ankle. And things like that. So they were really mean to each other, and so it was a very nasty fight. Have any of you ever had nasty fights like this with best friend? So on. Started to call each other body parts and so on. So it got pretty bad. So now, because they lived on farms, they both knew how to work large equipment, which is where problems really begin. And Walt happened to have a backhoe, and he was really angry. And he said, "You know what? Joe's taking the cow. This is totally unfair. I'm going to divide our land, so if anything wanders by, it's staying on my land." So he took his backhoe late at night when he thought Joe wouldn't notice, because backhoes are very quiet. And he dug right down the line of their property, just big ditch right there between the property. So this is my side and this is your side. So this is called demarcation. Have any of you ever drawn a line in the sand for somebody? There you go. This backhoe does this much more effectively. Yeah, so you keep that in mind. So, you know, old Joe woke up the next morning and he stares off across his land, because his window looks out across the land there, and he sees this giant ditch between he and Walt. And this, of course, makes him pretty sad and very angry at the same time, because that's, you know, this is a sure sign that things are falling apart. And yet, he's got to retaliate. He's very, very angry. And he's thinking, "What can I do? What can I do? This is, I got to show him that I don't care that he's dug this ditch, that I really don't care." Well, at that point, this wandering, itinerant handyman, possibly an out-of-work civil engineer, comes by, knocks on the door, and Joe answers the door, and the guy's got a box of tools and so on. He's, "I'm looking for work." And he thinks, "You know, I've got just the thing. I'm going to put up a fence. I'm going to put up a really amazing fence. I want it to run right along my side of the ditch. I want it to have barbed wire. I want it to look dangerous. Can you build me that?" And, I'm a civil engineer. Of course I can build something like that. I get some road graders, some things. We'll put in some posts. We'll put in some wire. And so he's like, "Great." And he goes, but he can't stand to watch it. So he goes out. So Walt says, "Okay, get to work on the fence. I got a bunch of stuff in the shed here that you can use to build it, and just make it. I want it to look mean. I don't want to, you know, I don't want Walt to look and see that I didn't recognize what he's done." So the civil engineer, carpenter, handyman says, "Sure, get right to work on that." Old Joe goes out. He's got shopping to do. He's going to go hang out at the local brew fest with his buddies, because there's a lot of people that he wants to be friends with still. And so he goes off, and he doesn't return till late that night, and he's coming back, and I wonder what that fence looks like at night. Maybe he's put up some floodlights. It'll be really cool. And he comes in his driveway, and he parks, and he goes out, and he looks back over to the field where he knows the ditches, and he's just waiting to see what his fence is going to look like, and he doesn't see a fence. What do you think he sees? He sees a bridge. This civil engineer has built a bridge across the ditch. And he's not sure what to think about that. But all of a sudden, his old friend Walt comes walking out of the house, and he comes across the bridge, and he says, "I can't believe this. I was so angry at you. I cut this ditch across our lawn. I tore us apart more than we ever were before. And you built a bridge. You built this to join us back together. That shows something I hadn't thought about." And old Joe has to kind of admit, well, he's like, "Well, actually, I kind of wanted a fence." But this guy I hired thought of this for me. He actually didn't follow my directions very well, but he thought of doing this for me. And they got back together, and they became friends again. They raised the calf. They put it in the clubs and so on, and they won blue ribbons, and both of them were very proud of it. And they became best friends again. And they both thought, you know, this guy was really good to us. We should hire him to do other things. They said, hey, you're wandering around here, and this bridge was a great idea. Can you help us and build more things?" And the civil engineer said, I'm afraid not. I have a lot of other places I need to go to build bridges." And so that's something for you guys to think about. Where are the places that you've taken a small backhoe in your imagination, maybe, and dug a hole between some people that you ought to be friends with, or that it would be good to get to know? And think about being not old Joe or Walt there, but thinking about being the wandering civil engineer that's building bridges. And that's the end of our story today. Now, who's our lantern bearer?
Children leave. Now is the time in our service for our joys and concerns. We invite everybody in the congregation to take a moment to share if they so desire. The ushers will bring around a microphone. Please raise your hand if you have something to share, and they'll bring a microphone. Introduce yourself briefly and tell us what your joy and or concern is, and I will light a candle to represent that joy or concern. First, I will light the memorial candle to acknowledge the many conflicts in the world. May a peaceful resolution be found to them, and may we remember how to talk with one another. Now I invite you all to share.
Light a candle of concern for the family of a high school friend who passed away this last week. She was battling leukemia her whole life. So I went to the service this week, and it was just really sad. And a lot of my friends are really, really sad, so a candle of concern for all of them.
My name is Fran, and I would like you to light a candle of joy, because last Saturday, one of my daughters was married. And I just adore her new husband, Greg, and his family. And it was just wonderful. And I left the wedding at 1:30 Sunday morning, and there were still people dancing. So it was great. It was great. Thank you.
My name is Eric, and I'd like to light a candle of concern for my friend Sherry, who's experiencing some health issues right now.
My name is Tom. During the 1980s, I lived and worked in St. Louis, and I had a coworker at that time who had become a very good friend of mine. And he contacted me in the last week, and he's had a pretty difficult time. He was contacting me from a homeless shelter in North Carolina, had been through a couple of suicide attempts and some kind of breakdown. He portrayed himself as recovering, and please light a candle of hope that that's true.
I'm Ellen, and I have a joy because my grandpa's here with me today. And also, my brother's birthday, Calvin, was about a week ago, and he's in China and having a really good time.
My name is Ginger, and this is Mike, and it's our 24th wedding anniversary today.
And I will light one final candle for all the joys and concerns we hold in our hearts.
Please join me in a time of meditation, reflection, and prayer. Spirit of life and love, Spirit breathing in us and through us and all around us, breathing through our lungs, coursing through our veins, and settling deep within our bones. We gather today as a community to give thanks, to celebrate the rising sun amidst the chilly morning. We gather as religious people who are journeying towards truth and towards meaning, unified in our diversity, enriched by the wealth of our individual paths. But we also gather each week to share in community the joys and the sorrows on our hearts. May we find the strength to lean on this community in times of hardship and loss, struggle and pain, knowing that someday we might need to be leaned on and return the sacred call of our interdependence. Spirit of life, we pause now for a moment of shared silence, lifting in our hearts both the spoken and unspoken longings of our souls. Spirit of life and love, breathe in us new life this morning. May our hearts course peace and healing throughout our bodies. And may we never forget that we are all co-journeys on this miraculous path of life and love. Amen.
When no flags flew, when no army stood, my land.
Good morning. It is definitely a good morning to be with you all here, familiar faces of some, and new that I'm appreciating every second. Thank you for being here. I have two readings to share with you today. They both come from the book Acts of Faith, the story of an American Muslim, the struggle for the soul of a generation, written by Dr. Eboo Patel. My first college memory is at the gym. There are three basketball games going on, a black game, an Asian game, and a white game. I am confused, but not about who I am. I know I am white. I have spent years making myself so. That is why I started playing basketball in the first place. It is what the popular white kids at my school did. I figured the physical defect of my brown skin would be overlooked if I perfected a 15-foot jump shot. The basketball court, to my eyes, was a big bucket of skin whitener. I looked at the black and Asian kids. They seemed so comfortable. They shouted at one another up and down the court in a distinct flow, ran pick and rolls and give and goes in their own unique rhythms. Didn't they want to play on the white court? Hadn't they spent years making its moves their own? Isn't that what it meant to be colored in America? The world has never seemed so new to me as it did in those first few months of college. My first lesson was on race. I was stunned to realize that not everybody wanted to be white. I remember seeing a Korean girl I had gone to high school with across the hall from me at the Illini Union. "Kristen," I called out, but she didn't turn around. She went back to her Korean name, a mutual friend, also Korean, later explained to me. She won't answer to Kristen anymore. "Well, what the hell is that all about?" I asked. "It happens to a lot of Koreans when they go to college. They become more involved in their own ethnicity and culture. They decide to hang out only with other Koreans." She was using college as a place to de-whiten herself. And the more I looked around, the more I realized that she wasn't the only one. Cafeterias were balkanized by race and ethnicity. And unlike in high school, where the popular, mostly white kids sat at one table and others longed for a place there, people wanted to be where they were. And in fact, they were fiercely proud and protective of their own zones. The first time I met Azeem Nanji, I had a feeling that he was a man who would play a key role in my life. A well-regarded professor of Islamic studies who had chaired the Department of Religion at the University of Florida, Azeem had recently been appointed by the Ismaili Imam as the director of the Institute of Ismaili Studies in London. I went to see him in the fall of my first year at Oxford and told him that I was interested in doing a doctorate on Ismaili religious education programs. He nodded his approval. But Azeem knew that I was interested in something more significant than a doctorate. I was embarking on an intensely personal journey. The perspective I brought to Islam had been shaped by my admiration for Dorothy Day, Mahatma Gandhi, and the Dalai Lama, as well as my friendships with Kevin and Brother Wayne. I loved the spirituality and social justice in Christianity, Hinduism, Judaism, and Buddhism. I had no interest in Islam until my most recent trip to India, when the Dalai Lama had told me to be a good Muslim, and I had seen my grandmother model what that meant. Now I wanted to learn about the tradition behind her spiritual equanimity and service ethic. Were there heroes in my faith like Abraham Joshua Heschel and Martin Luther King Jr.? Did it have poets like Tagore and Black, philosophers like Maimonides and Aquinas? Had my faith helped free countries the way that Gandhi's Hinduism had? Did it have mouth-widening beauty like the Sistine Chapel? I knew nothing about Islam, except that it lived in my bones. I wanted desperately for it to be magnificent. And without me explaining any of this directly, Azim somehow understood that this was the animating impulse behind my dissertation topic. He looked at me intently as I explained what I wanted to research. And then he said, So many of us begin our careers by studying our history and then locating ourselves within it. My own dissertation was in a similar area. You are living at a time when Islam can go in many different directions, and it will be young people like you that will shape its next steps. Having an understanding of the humanistic dimensions of Muslim history and how to teach them most effectively is about as important an education as you can get. I want you to know that my door will always be open for you. We live in a very precarious time in human history. Countries around the world are facing economic collapse, political revolution, and intense social upheaval. But here in America, not much is different. Our daily papers and our nightly news reporters fill our hearts with sadness of the constant barrage of human suffering and pain inflicted upon our fellow brothers and sisters. Young boys are being shot down on the south side of Chicago. An Iraqi veteran was sent to the ICU for just protesting at Occupy Oakland. The unemployment rate remains ever high, and all the while it seems that our elected officials remain deadlocked in an ideological stalemate. Without a doubt, our earth remains in a state of shock, busting at the seams as it exceeds 7 billion residents. But amidst all of this turmoil, surrounded by all of this darkness, there is hope. There is hope. It is in me and it is in you, and it fills this space that is made sacred this morning just by your shared presence here. We come together as Unitarian Universalists each Sunday because we believe in a world unseen, in a world unfolding beneath our feet, becoming manifest by our compassionate hands and our warm, loving hearts. And every weekend, billions of other people around the world gather in places of worship just like this one, not to run away from the realities out there, but to be reminded each and every day of the headlines that didn't make the Today Show or the nightly news. When I worked for Dr. Eboo Patel, the president and founder of the Interfaith Youth Corps, he spoke often about the stories that we were not being told by the media, those that signify not only the potentiality for social cohesion, but the reality that people from diverse backgrounds actually do come together and work together each and every day to make the world a better place. Because we live in a world where it is easy to get pessimistic, cynical, and just plain tired of trying to hold it together in one piece. Progressive people, both religious and secular alike, are becoming frustrated beyond measure by the widening divisions in society, as has been made clear by the Occupy movement, which continues to be relevant and present, especially in Boston, Chicago, and New York. But what is more troubling to me than living within this tenuous globalized world is the fact that hundreds of millions of young people are coming of age and entering adulthood in this time of great uncertainty. As a young adult and a lifelong Unitarian Universalist, I resonate already retrospectively considering the difference between my transition into this stage of life compared to many of you here this morning that are only now becoming aware of the world that you're about to dive headfirst into. It seems as if in just the last 5 years or so, we have journeyed into dangerous waters, not uncharted, but rarely traversed in recent history. And so I ask all of us today to consider how we as religious leaders will respond to the needs of our youth and our young adults as they progress through this time of great revelation and transformation. However, this discourse is not solely related to the well-being of our youth and our young adults, but to the entirety of our faith tradition. Because as Unitarian Universalists, we promote the interconnected web of existence of which we are all a part. And because we cannot subdivide the symbolic web, because our souls and our hearts are woven in together. Clipping away South Sudan or South Chicago or the cares or the needs of any part of our global family must be understood as a serious spiritual detriment, which will only foster a similar ideological stalemate that is, who is my brother? Who is my sister as the one that's going on in Washington, D.C.? So the pursuit of effective youth and young adult ministries is the pursuit of dynamic intergenerational ministries, and I do believe that this journey towards effective leadership around these issues begins and ends with a greater realization of, an engagement with, and an appreciation for our fourth Unitarian Universalist principle. The reality of our fourth principle, which is that we are all afforded a free and responsible search for truth and meaning, is that it is not only a very progressive theological stance, a liberating theological stance, but it is also a very demanding task. I once delivered a sermon where I articulated the disparate demands the adjectives free and responsible place upon our paths towards truth and meaning. Freedom is a wonderfully simple qualifier. Like a kid in a candy shop, we can run for the Skittles, follow it up with a couple malted milk balls, completely avoid the Twizzlers altogether, and finish it off with some terribly time-consuming but ultimately satisfying Gobstoppers. But then we must push the metaphor further and question our level of responsibility as a result of our candy binge and our sugar high. What parts of our diet are we not fulfilling to remain healthy individuals? And now, the reason I bring this up is not to scold the sweet tooth in the audience, but rather, I want to lift up the dual reality to show my deep appreciation for both the freedom this principle grants us, but also the demands for spiritual responsibility that comes with it. Simply put, I find no greater embodiment of this responsibility in spiritual formation than in the moments of engagement between people across religious and philosophical boundaries. When we can come together, not despite our differences, but because we share a common longing for peace and justice in the world, we begin to see the magic manifest. The civil rights movement in the 1950s and 60s was an example of this when the Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel and the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. marched together in solidarity for equal housing, employment, and voting rights. 9/11 was another example of this. While a horrible day in world history, it helped us realize our need for building authentic, sustainable, interfaith relationships between communities and nations. And since then, the growth of interfaith organizations and partnerships in the world has skyrocketed as people begin to realize that we need to come together, that we have a stake in each other's lives. And the Occupy movement is one of the most recent manifestations in history of people wanting to come together regardless of religious background. Occupy Wall Street in New York is inherently an interfaith movement. One experience I've had with the Occupy movement was when I chanted and sang in downtown Chicago with Muslims and Jews, Christians and atheists, and individuals from various life journeys. And in this diversity, in our shared longings for peace and for greater economic equality, we began to see that world unseen. We began to realize that our future was springing up beneath our marching feet, emitting warmly from our shared embrace and pouring out from our loving songs. And as a result of this movement reaching from coast to coast and everywhere in between and even abroad, I believe that there is something more powerful than frustration and anger being realized by tens of thousands of people across this country. There is an energy and a life present at these rallies and rallies just like it, a palpable exuberance among the people of these gatherings, perhaps consequence of many factors, but one of them, I am sure, is a growing realization of what it means to be human living in the 21st century. Identity formation is an inevitable and crucial component of social justice movements, as the movement causes us as individuals to ask, will I move? But before we can ask this question, we must ask an age-old question, who am I to move in the first place? Every single religious community asks this question, along with those related to our origins, where do we come from, and our journeys, where are we going, and our associations to others. Who am I in relation to the world around me? Gandhi asked these questions on his ashram in Gujarat, the Dalai Lama in his monastery in Tibet, Muhammad in Mecca, Maimonides in Morocco, and Jesus in the land of Israel. Countless others, including each and every one of us in this room, ask these deeply personal questions. This is our fourth principle. And this is also the case for members of youth groups and young adult groups in our UU churches throughout the country. This time of life is a particularly challenging time, no matter which way you approach it. We as young people are beginning to grapple with issues of sexuality and gender, race and class, vocational direction and economic worries. We balance between, on the one hand, complete eagerness to take the world by storm, go to college, and be free. But then, on the other hand, a deep fear of the unknown overwhelms us, of the world that awaits us, and the paths our journeys may take. Eboo Patel's memoir, Acts of Faith, The Story of an American Muslim, The Struggle for the Soul of a Generation, articulates this dual journey of discovering oneself while understanding it in relation to the collective time we share together on this planet. Dr. Patel, who grew up in Glen Ellyn, Illinois, a primarily white and relatively wealthy suburb of Chicago, struggled to understand his identity as an Indian American Muslim growing up in a culture where he was clearly other. As our first reading indicated, his time growing up was fueled by shame and even self-hatred. He desired to fit in with the white culture that surrounded him, where he could simply shoot hoops, just be normal. But in college, he began to realize that this longing for singularity and identity was not the norm. College became a laboratory for experimenting with one's identity, where one could be free to express oneself without rebuke. And through this struggle of understanding about who he was as an individual, he began to realize the richness and the diversity of human existence and experience. Dr. Patel came to an affirmation of his own Muslim identity and family history in part through meeting and engaging with people from different religious backgrounds. His encounters with religious people in college carried over into his doctoral studies, where he eventually got his PhD in the sociology of religion from Oxford. In other words, Dr. Patel wanted to understand the power religion could and does have in uniting people around common causes for making the world better. He learned about the Beatitudes of Jesus, the noble truths of Buddha, the concept of tikkun olam in Judaism and tawhid in Islam, and was overwhelmed by the compassionate points of intersection in these traditions and teachings. Could bringing people together around these shared commitments be a venue for eradicating the injustice and violence in the world? Well, Dr. Patel surely believes so, as his organization, the Interfaith Youth Corps, has become one of the largest and most successful interfaith nonprofits in the world in just the last decade or so. The IFYC strategically considered the various venues to engage communities with opportunities for interfaith engagement, and empowering young people in college was agreed upon to be the most logical approach. For young people in this country are not only the shapers of tomorrow, but also a powerful factor for social change today. Look at any election. The Occupy movement is just one example of this as well, because it is largely run and maintained by young people under the age of 35. This book, Acts of Faith, articulates in my mind a growing edge we as Unitarian Universalists could and maybe should take to heart. Not only does it offer us an opportunity to consider the method of spiritual formation for our youth and our young adults in our religious tradition, but I think it also allows us to have a much deeper discussion. Are we responsibly living out our fourth principle? Are we called to greater engagement with people of various religious traditions to learn from each other and to work together to improve the world of which we are all co-residents? Or perhaps, an even more engaging question, how can we engage more holistically with the religious diversity within our own congregations? I felt for several years now that we as Unitarian Universalists stand as a faith tradition at a great precipice of revolution. But not a violent or political revolution of which we are more accustomed to, or perhaps even frightened of because of media representations of them. Rather, we gather today at the genesis of what I hope to be an ongoing spiritual revolution, a revolution of the heart, of the soul, a spinning dance of repositioning our focus towards a greater attention to the power interreligious engagement can play within our own spiritual practices, individually as well as collectively. And we are primed for this revolution. Our UU principles practically present a 7-point argument about why we should engage with people of various religious traditions. Many congregations are already doing this in various ways. For example, First Unitarian Chicago in Hyde Park, where I attend regularly, has a spiritual pluralism project, which seeks to give space for those who are interested in engaging with people within the congregation who embrace various theologies, rituals, and/or religious practices. And these encounters foster a spirit of greater religious pluralism within the larger congregation. And other congregations try and work with neighboring religious communities in the area on issues of advocacy and community service. But regardless of which one you do, these two examples show that the diversity is not just beyond these four walls, but right here in this space this morning. Now, I'm not trying to be controversial or suggest we completely rewrite what it means to be a Unitarian Universalist. What I'm advocating for is that we continue to consider the place of interfaith engagement and formation in the work of our congregations, in the work of our association, and in the work of our individual life journeys. Interreligious programming at this congregation will inevitably be different than a First Unitarian in Chicago, as it would be different on the East Coast or the West Coast or anywhere in between. However, I do believe that there is an intimately profound connection between the themes presented in Dr. Patel's book and the future of our faith tradition. Acts of Faith was named last year's Common Read by the UUA, which means churches throughout the country have been, and I hope will continue, to organize events and book reading groups to consider how this may become a book of great inspiration and direction for our religious movement. Ultimately, I consider this book to not only be very well written, but also written for individuals just like all of us, young and old and everywhere in between, because identity formation does not end at 18 or 21 or 30 or 90. Struggles regarding sexuality and gender, career path, and economic stability are issues that do not discriminate by age. And they also definitely do not discriminate by religious tradition. So then it is not far-fetched to consider that interfaith ministries may be a path towards effective intergenerational work, which is a path towards effective youth and young adult work in our congregations, because we are all here, all of us, in this place. But not just this place, but this place, earth, our home, together. Whether you're a Buddhist or a Muslim, Christian or Jewish, Unitarian, Universalist, all of these, none of these, we must affirm our shared humanity in one another. We must see the face of the other in the dark. We must awaken to the coming day. Because we're all on a journey. And we are all in this spiritual revolution as one global family. And if we can unite in this venture, I do believe the prospect of Unitarian Universalism is quite bright in the 21st century. A central part of the Unitarian Universalist Coming of Age program is the time when we send our youth to various places of worship so that they may experience the culture and practice of different religious traditions. This was a powerful experience for me, and perhaps it was what initially got me interested in interfaith engagement. I can't state this enough. The children and youth and young adults in this room, the youth that are at the Catholic Church this morning, I believe, are bright and shining symbols of the future before this congregation and before our collective religious tradition. They are coming of age. I, too, am coming of age. And yes, all of us are still coming of age because, in fact, the world is coming of age. $7 billion is a very large number. And it takes a certain level of maturity and spiritual leadership to build a cohesive global community amidst this diversity. It also takes a certain nuance in leadership in our religious communities to address the needs of our local communities. And so may our leadership in our churches and wider communities be beacons of this hope and this promise. May we never stop coming of age, growing in love, and journeying down our paths of spiritual revolution. Please, let's make it so. Amen.
The church is a community of ourselves. Its energy and resources are our energy and resources. Its wealth is what we share. As we contribute to the life of this community, we affirm our lives within it. The gifts of the congregation will now be gratefully received.
Thank you.
have a few minutes for a polylog, and Nick is very interested in getting some feedback and hearing questions and answering them. He'll also be here after the service to talk with the youth group and in the social hour, so there's questions there as well. If you have a question, raise your hand, and Usher will bring you a microphone, introduce yourself, and ask your question.
I must say that your daughter, according to my girlfriend's father in Appleton, who's the lead minister at the Appleton Church, that your daughter is kind of is still the stalwart of young adult ministries at that group. So, yes, the highest growing number of religious identities today is none. And a large portion of that are youth and young adults. That's not happenstance. There is a correlation between there because of a lack of interest young people are having within this thing called organized religion and traditional organized religion, of which in many ways Unitarian Universalists are still plagued by. And that's not to say it's bad. That doesn't mean organized religion or this kind of worship structure is not fulfilling. For many, many people, including myself, but it's a fact that there is something more nuanced in spiritual formation today that youth and young adults are not, especially, but there are older people as well who are falling out of religious life, are not receiving. And so I think what's interesting on college campuses, which I can speak to a little bit, is that a lot of interfaith organizations on college campuses are partnering a lot with secular groups on campuses. Like there's large chapters of secular student alliances in schools, which are as a national office and stuff like that. And there seems to be a lot of partnership and interest, a growing interest of atheists or agnostics or non-religious people who are moving away from a more militaristic understanding of what it means to be non-religious, and more towards a cooperative engagement with people of faith, finding these shared commitments. And if there is a book that you read this year, it should be a book called Faithiest by a good friend of mine, Chris Stedman. Faithiest, it's like the word faith, and it kind of flows into the word atheist. I don't know exactly where the I fits in, but in faith. But it's a beautiful book about a young man. He's a couple years older than me, and he works at Harvard, and he worked at Interfaith Youth Corps with Eboo Patel as well. But now he works at Harvard in the humanist office, humanist chaplaincy office, and he wrote a book about why atheists need to come together with people of faith and to work together. It's a great memoir, and I really recommend it. Now, in regards to congregational life, and reaching out to people in the Heartland, Sussex, Pewaukee area, these are very hard things to do because a lot of people are either extreme zealots with their religious identity or very don't ask, don't tell with their religious identity. And so you go down a street and you'd be like, you wouldn't even know, but there might be like five houses in a row would be perfect new additions to that class you're offering. So I would say, just in brief conclusion, I mean, this is a really tough topic, but I would say the more you're willing to continue to live in the liminal space between individual identity and community identity, where what defines us as individuals as opposed to what defines us as community, in that middle space will allow for people to enter and say, there's space for me here. But if the minister every week is saying things that are more exclusive, even if it sounds very inclusive, you have to think about language, course, adult curriculum offerings, various things, the way that culture in our congregations exist. It can be very implicitly and very sinister, exclusive. And it's hard to see. But I'm working on it. I'll get back to you.
My name is Gus. Over here, Nick.
Thank you.
You referred twice in your sermon about the unseen. And I think one of the issues you were trying to address and did address was the making it happen. The fact that if there's going to be changes, we have to create them. And part of the problem I see with those who, at least this is my estimation of those who choose none, is because they're sick and tired of the metaphysics of religion and talking about things that they can't simply relate to. And I think one of the problems is the fact that because there is an aspect of consciousness that simply comes out of nothing whatsoever and has to deal with the world as it is, that the emphasis on creativity needs to be there, and the fact that I can create my own religion because of the fact that I'm free and I can do that, to make what is unseen therefore seen, because what is unseen is in fact also unreal. What is seen is real.
Right. Thank you. And I've been thinking a lot about creativity lately, and I think what really helps is to take the metaphysical understanding, which I assume no one in this room thinks that the world was created in 7 days, that it was more kind of myth and that kind of stuff, but to take that and kind of turn it on its head and say that the world is still being created in, what, 6.4 billion years. That creation doesn't end. That we're all co-creators in this world. That it's still being seen. That the world is still being created. Because if you stop it at 7 days, then everything else is just playing out of chemical reactions back and forth until dust or something. But if you move to a place where you think that we are all co-creators, that we're all co-creators of this ongoing revelation is one term, or greater seeing, or greater appreciation of this world, turning over every rock and all these different things, then people, especially humanists and non-religious people, can find practical applications of this faith tradition. But if it's just, this is what it is, Unitarian Universalism is always going to be white, wealthy, and well-educated. That's what we are. But if people say, no, we're still creating our living tradition, your hymnal, then there's so much more possibility, and I think so much more applicability for those people. Those things are springing up more and more, and the idea is how can we get more people engaged with these opportunities, and so that it doesn't become I think it's become kind of a hip thing to do, like interfaith engagement. It's kind of like the new fad, the new cool music out, you know, and like it's one thing in a calendar month that you could participate in. Whereas we begin, and this is something I'm, you know, if you're coming to GA this year, I'm proposing a workshop. On how do we get a greater theological framework for this, so it makes more sense, so that we can move beyond just like, oh, it's a fun thing to do, it makes sense, politically correct thing to do, but move it towards, there is some kind of existential imperative for me to engage in this work. that somehow my spiritual formation is wrapped up in the formation of others, in our interconnectedness, seventh principle, so that my spiritual formation is somewhat unfinished, or more unfinished, if I don't engage across lines of religious difference. And when we can get there, that's when, like, it gets really good. It gets really good. And I also want to say, Dr. Patel is our WARE lecturer this year at GA. And if you haven't been to GA, it's in Louisville this year. It's a great assembly of several thousand Unitarian Universalists. And the WARE lecture is a yearly lecture that we've had some phenomenal speakers, including King and Kurt Vonnegut and Mary Oliver and some wonderful speakers. And this year, Dr. Patel is coming to speak. And it is going to be a fantastic, fantastic lecture, I know. And his new book just came out called Sacred Ground. Please look that one up, too. Do we have to start? He is just a little bunny. He just goes all over the country all the time. You won't miss him. He's very charismatic.
So this conversation can go on. It doesn't have to be just here. And I invite us afterwards to come to the social time and continue the conversation. At this point, we're going to close with our closing hymn, number 318. Please rise as you're willing and able and join in singing.
I believe in a world unseen. I believe in a world unfolding beneath our feet, emitting warmly from our shared embrace and clearly pouring out from our loving songs. Come, let us continue to come of age, journey together, and never stop down our paths of spiritual revolution. Amen.